To order?
Okay.
Can I call the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary also to order? I just want to let you know, we have two members that appear to not be here, but one I know is on the phone. Senator Cruz is joining us. He had to start heading south to get back home and take care of some matters, and he was also somewhat under the weather, and I told him I prefer him not sitting next to me if he's sick. So we all agreed that he could take off, but he is following us on the phone, and I believe Senator Rosenbaum is also will be joining us. And I also want to say special thanks to Senator Thatcher for being here under the situations with the rehab and also the weather being like it is. So thank you very, very much for being here.
Thank you. And I'm going to open a quick work session on the House side. A vote, we're going to be introducing some bills. A vote in favor of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. Okay. So I don't want anybody yawning while I read all these. We're going to be here for a few minutes. Okay. LC 271 is dated 8/24/2016. LC 333, 6/30/16. LC 818 is 11/29/26.
633.
Did I miss that one?
Yep.
Yeah. 633.
LC 633 is 8/19/2016. LC 819, 6/19, 2016. LC 820, 6/28, 2016. LC 831 is 8/23, 2016. LC 832, 6/28, 2016. LC 835, or correction, 835 is 12/8, 2016. LC 836, 10/24/2016. LC 985 is 10/6/2016. LC 986 is dated 8/3/2016. LC 1006 is dated 10/3/2016. LC 1007 is dated 12/14/16. LC 1080 dated 11/2/2016. LC 1081 is dated 11/30/2016. LC 1090 is dated 10/11/2016. And Representative Leininger, I'm just curious if you would like to continue.
Thank you so much. LC 1091 is dated 12/11/2016. 2016. So this is really harder than you'd think it was.
Yeah, they say the eyes are the first thing that go.
All right, LC 1093, dated 9/8/2016. LC 1094, 12/13/2016. LC 1409, 12/6/2016. LC 1699, 10/18/2016. LC 1700, 12/8/2016, LC 1702, 12/1/2016, LC 1733, 11/18/2016, LC 1734, 11/14/2016, LC 1788, 12/1/2016, LC 1789, 10/25/2016, LC 1790, 11/29/2016, LC 1821, 10/5/2016, LC 1840, 11/8/2016, LC 1854, 10/26/2016, LC 1933, 12/12/2016, LC 1960, 11/30/2016, LC 21/23, 11/10/2017, that says, is that right?
Pardon me, that is 16.
Okay, LC 21/23, 11/10/2016. LC 2310, 11/23/2016, LC 2565, 11/23/2016, LC 2570, 11/15/2016, LC 2572, 11/10/2016, LC 2652, 12/5/2016, LC 3177, 12/14/2016. I was ready for the mic drop moment. That's it.
Can you make a motion?
Okay.
has made the motion, so this is where you pick up.
Okay, Representative Olson moves to introduce the LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Thank you.
Your turn.
Thank you.
All right. And the Senate is also going to be introducing its LCs for consideration during the 2017 session. And as Co-Chair Barker said, a vote for in favor of introducing the legislative concepts is not a vote on the merits of the concepts. It is it's not indicative of how a member's opinions or positions are on the concepts and the contents within those concepts, and it does not bind them in any shape, way, form, manner that they will support the measure once it is introduced and comes to whatever committee it comes to. And that's the last part I do want to make clear. Even though we are introducing many various LCs, there's no guarantee that each and every one of these LCs will actually make it into the Senate Judiciary Committee. The President of the Senate will take his wisdom and decide on which is the appropriate committee based on the subject matter. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the Senate is getting its money's worth out of me today. Chair Przanski, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 423, 822, 2016, LC 830, 12-1-2016, LC 834, 720-16, LC 837, 7-5-2016, LC 929, 8-19-16, LC 930, 8-30-16, LC 1076, 9-29-16, LC 1578, 9-29-16, LC 1579, 11-10-16, LC 1747, 11-17-16, LC 2059, 12-6-16, LC 2081, 10-13-16, LC 2086, 11-7-16, LC 2087, 11-16-16, LC 2088, 10-13-16, LC 2093, 10-14-16, LC 2014, 10-17-16, LC 2125, 10-13-16, LC 2127, 10-14-16, LC 2152, 10-13-16, LC 2153, 10-7-16, LC 2154, 10-7-16, LC 2155, 10-13-16, LC 2161, 10-11-16, LC 2184, 11-10-16, LC 2274, 11-30-16, LC 2299, 10-11-16, LC... And LC 2328, 11-18-16, LC 2335, 10-26-2016, and last but not least, LC 2336, 10-20-16.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. Senator Rosenbaum moves for the introduction of the LC she just referenced in her motion as committee measures. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? And just to clarify, since we do have a member on the phone, Senator Cruz, I just want to make certain you heard the question as to whether you had any objection, and if you do...
I heard the question, Mr. Chair, and I have no objection.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Seeing none, the measures are introduced. Thank you for all on the Senate side for being here on this day. I know that some of you may need to take off because of family needs and travel. If so, please just let us know on your way out.
Mr. Chairman, on the Senate side, I'd like to nominate Senator Rosenbaum to read those from now on, because that was really good. I know how hard that is, and since Representative Olson absolutely butchered ours, would you be so kind as to do that from now on? I'd really appreciate that.
Representative Post, we will take that as a great motion, and I mean, it shows you how well she was thinking on her feet, where we actually threw in a little duplicate in there. She caught it.
So she did great.
Thank you, Mr.
Very
Chair.
Good. And, and I'd like to move on just briefly. We have, because some people are going to have to leave today, We have some people who won't be back next year, and I want to thank Representative Krieger for a long career in public service, a long career with the Oregon State Police, and then he came to the legislature, and he's just wrapping up 16 years in Salem. It's about a seven-hour drive for him to get to here from his home, which makes for some, you know, he barely gets home and has to turn around and come back on the weekends, he and his wife, Colleen. And Wayne, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate it. I really appreciate our personal working together. You've done a great job in judiciary, both as chairman, co-chairman, and member up there. And thank you very, very much for your service.
Thank you.
And with that, I also would like to recognize Senator Rosenbaum. We had the opportunity in the Senate because we had a floor session for approval on appointments to have some say on the floor, but I think it's very important to say in the committee as well how much we appreciate Diane for all the work that you've done, for all the years that you've put forward. And I know that this is not the end, that we will in fact see you back here, hopefully in multiple capacities. So thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairs. And if I could just also congratulate Representative Krieger on his years of service. And one of my fondest memories of Representative Krieger is that when I was over on the House side, my own staff, Reagan Gray, who is still around, and her husband, Georgia Coolidge, they weren't married at the time, but said to me how much she enjoyed working with the Kriegers because they actually read every single word of every bill, which very rarely happens in this body. And so I want to applaud you, Representative Krieger, for doing yeoman's work for many, many years. I admire you, and congratulations.
I would like to say, Chair, is that it was obvious that everybody loved my wife, and they put up with me.
Amen.
I also wanted to just say a word about Representative Krieger since I didn't get to be on the floor. I love your poetry. I still have a framed piece of your poetry in my office, and I really appreciated, especially in my first session, the dinner dates that you put together, bringing people together from both sides of the aisle to really get to know each other in different kinds of ways. As a new member, that was really important to me and helped me meet and get to know people I otherwise might not have had the chance to do that with. And then I've also really enjoyed the chance to work with you on issues around children and adoption and foster care, and you'll be very missed.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Representative Krieger as well. I think what Representative Gelser just said, your commitment to kids and to the structure and ensuring that their rights are protected will go on for in the future. And I know that there's been a lot of work and there's still a lot of work to do. So please don't hesitate to let us know how we are not doing what we need to do so we can get it right. Thank you.
Okay, and as we said, and I know a lot of people here need to get out too is with the storm and so on. So we'll try to really expedite today. We're having an informational meeting, an update on House Bill 2002 work group on the prevention of profiling by law enforcement. And I'll call up, if you want to come in different order, but Attorney General Rosenblum, Sheriff Myers, and Jamma Casey, please. And you can go in any order. Remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Oregon Attorney General. Chairs Prozonsky and Barker, Vice Chairs Cruz and Olson, members of the committee, good afternoon. If I might, just as a point of personal privilege, also congratulate and thank Senator Rosenbaum and also Representative Krieger. You may not know this, but Representative Krieger at one time volunteered to serve on a committee that I chaired while I was on the Oregon Court of Appeals. And this was a committee to revise the Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct. And Representative Krieger came to just about every meeting and was a wonderful participant. And that is how I got to know him. And so I just want to say that he was always going beyond what he already had on his plate. And we just appreciate it so much. And I think he came over a few times specifically for that meeting as well. So thank you, Representative, and all the best to you and Colleen. In 2000, 2015, this body passed House Bill 2002, which made Oregon the 31st state to define and prohibit profiling by law enforcement. This bill also tasked me as Attorney General with convening a task force assigned with identifying patterns and practices of profiling by law enforcement and identifying methods to correct these practices. In December 2015, our task force returned written recommendations to the Joint Committee on Judiciary and were asked by this body through 2016's House Bill 4003 to reconvene our task force and codify our recommendations as a fully developed legislative concept. I return to you now to announce that the task force has completed its work and has reached consensus in recommending to you what is now labeled as Legislative Concept 420. LC 420 largely follows the approach we outlined to you 1 year ago, recommending targeted training investments to help our officers better understand the dynamics of implicit bias, mandating the collection of stop data to help us better understand who is being stopped, who is being searched, and who is being let off with a warning, and using that data to drive a transparent public conversation about how to address and correct any bias that may be discovered. While the conversation about profiling by law enforcement is not new, our understanding of the root causes of profiling has developed far more recently. Broadly speaking, what we understand as profiling can result from two different types of bias. The first of these, explicit bias, is the conscious exertion of preferential or antagonistic behavior targeted at a person on the basis of their race, gender, or other inappropriate characteristic, and represents a deliberate decision to engage in biased behavior. The second, implicit bias, is the largely unconscious result of social patterning and our own basic built-in neurological tendencies to prefer, on some level, individuals who we perceive to be like us. While implicit bias in law enforcement has received the majority of the attention by the public in recent years, ample evidence has demonstrated implicit biases in nearly all professions, ranging from strike zone judgments made by Major League Baseball umpires, employer hiring decisions, how teachers pay attention to students in the classroom, recommendations for cancer screenings made by physicians, and the amount of time lawyers spend with their clients. Both forms of bias are deeply problematic when present in the decision-making processes of law enforcement. Education and training are critical parts of correcting profiling behavior. And if that doesn't work, discipline and even termination may be called for. Despite its ubiquity, implicit bias responds well to training. Multiple studies have shown that with an appropriate course of study, individuals can acknowledge and overcome their biases. More than 20% of all large U.S. employers already utilize anti-implicit bias trainings in their workplace, and this number is climbing by the year. Our own Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST, began introducing implicit bias prevention trainings into the academy curriculum approximately 8 years ago. But this means that only our most recently graduated officers have had the opportunity to receive this important training. This does much to explain DPSST's estimate that only 35 to 40% of our law enforcement have received sufficient training on the elimination of implicit bias. And we need to push this number to 100%. Our task force recommends that DPSST require the completion of training related to implicit bias, cultural competency, and other fundamental skills essential to the prevention of profiling, not just on the academy levels, but as a continuing requirement for our law enforcement throughout their careers. Similarly, an officer who wishes to move into the highest levels of our law enforcement should be required to demonstrate their competency in the skills necessary to deter profiling by those they supervise. Our task force also proposes that Oregon follow Connecticut, California, and other states in requiring the statewide collection of data regarding traffic and pedestrian stops by law enforcement. While every interaction with law enforcement has the potential to tell an important story, it is only in the aggregation of data that we are able to observe patterns of profiling behavior. To give an example, an officer working traffic on the side of I-5 can pull just about anyone over because just about all of us are speeding. That's not an admission. I'll accept the Attorney General. Any one of those stops can be justified in isolation as a fair exercise of officer discretion.
But across hundreds or even thousands of stops, patterns can become visible. Patterns governing who is stopped, who is searched, and who is let off without a warning or whip. Our proposal would require law enforcement to submit certain data points reflecting the nature of any discretionary traffic stop or pedestrian stop, including the perceived race of the person stopped, whether the person was cited, whether they were searched, and whether they were arrested. This aggregated data would be passed on to the Criminal Justice Commission for analysis of any disparities of enforcement, which would be published as an annual report. The Criminal Justice Commission has an established track record of reducing complicated public safety data into user-friendly, easy-to-understand, highly interactive internet presentations available to the public. And I believe you'll see such a presentation later this afternoon. But if the data does suggest the existence of a possible pattern or practice of profiling, publication alone is not enough. Our legislation calls on and empowers DPSST, the agency directly responsible for the training and certification of our law enforcement, to provide any needed technical guidance to help assist a law enforcement agency which may be engaged in a pattern or practice of profiling, and to do so in a transparent manner by requiring this advice to also be shared with the local public safety coordinating council in the county where the law enforcement agency is based, in a public forum, and with the opportunity for community participation and input. The legitimacy of our law enforcement depends on public perception, and there is no accountability mechanism better than sunshine. Before I conclude my presentation, I do want to note another aspect of this proposed legislation. After much deliberation, the overwhelming majority of this task force requested that I consider including in my recommendations to you a statement urging the legislature to take up the important issue of reform to our drug policies. Our task force members came to this conclusion from many different perspectives: public safety, public health, the need for fair enforcement across the state, but none weighed on my decision more heavily than the strong historical link between the enforcement of drug policy and disparate impacts on diverse communities. Drug policy, particularly the imposition of felony sentences for small user quantity amounts, has been identified by academics as among the largest factors driving the felonization and disenfranchisement of our communities of color. Indeed, data suggests that in most states, a person of color is more than twice as likely to be arrested and convicted of a low-level drug offense, despite roughly comparable rates of drug use across races. The relevance to profiling is direct. If the most significant impact of profiling is the alienation experienced by the person profiled, the second most significant may be the heightened frequency of searches associated with profiling behavior. Members of this task force, including law enforcement, the ACLU, OCDLA, and Unite Oregon, are actively working with other stakeholders to develop legislation that will minimize the collateral consequences to otherwise non-criminal drug users while ensuring they get the treatment and the supervision that they need. The language in this proposal is meant to initiate and show our commitment to that conversation, but we recognize that there's much work that's left to be done. I will also note that our task force did not reach total consensus on this point, whereas we did on all other points. I will turn the presentation over to Sheriff Myers and to Casey Jama, both members of our task force, who will be followed by Ken Barone of Central Connecticut University. Ken is a policy and research specialist with the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy at Central Connecticut State, and has managed since 2012 the Connecticut Racial Profiling Project. He is here to share Connecticut's experience with the implementation of a statewide data collection system, the costs involved, and the lessons learned from the data. Thank you for your time, and I'm open for any questions.
Co-chairs, members of the House and Judiciary Committees, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and I have had the privilege of serving on this racial profiling task force as the Oregon State Police, or the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, sorry, this, I just saw the superintendent and it caught me off guard back there, representative. I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'd like to begin my remarks by thanking the Attorney General for her leadership on this task force. The Attorney General and her staff member have done an excellent job of providing an opportunity for all stakeholders to participate in this very relevant and important topic. The task force has worked its way through a variety of different issues and concerns in what I would describe as the Oregon way. a process characterized by listening, collaboration, and action. The racial profiling recommendations are a result of the task force efforts and are fully supported by the Oregon sheriffs and chiefs. Oregon sheriffs and chiefs remain steadfast in working diligently to be problem-solving oriented and thoughtful in the way that we approach community concerns. We also remain committed to collaboration and unity to provide fair, just, and equitable policing to all communities in Oregon. In closing, I'd like to echo the Attorney General's comment on the possession of controlled substance policy recommendations. The recommendations on this policy change haven't been negotiated yet. They have not gone through the robust conversation and vetting that the racial profiling recommendations have been through. While the sheriffs and chiefs support a different approach to possession of controlled substance, we feel that this policy must be thoroughly vetted so that we don't put our communities at greater risk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, chairs. For the record, my name is Casey Chama. I am the executive director of the Unite Oregon. I want to, first of all, as a member of the task force, acknowledge and also follow Sheriff Myers that we greatly appreciate the leadership of our Attorney General and her staff. They have done amazing work bringing us together and making sure that we stay on task and support us, provide us the technical assistance needed. I want to also acknowledge the community who has been really working hard on our coalition and making sure that we also hear the voices of the community and address their concerns. I want to thank for Urban League of Portland, who also has been partnered with us on this fight. I want to also acknowledge that Fair Shots Coalition, who has really been at the table for the last two sessions pushing this issue forward. Oregon Latino Health Coalition has also been partnered with us on this issue. Oregon Health Equity Alliance, and among many other 72 coalition members who all agreed this is an issue that Oregon needs to be a leader in our country. And I think we are moving forward in that direction. So I would really take an opportunity to say we need to be a leader in this issue as a state and make sure that our communities are all treated equally. By addressing profiling in our law enforcement agencies, it will build a trust between the law enforcement agencies and the community that they serve. It was great that our law enforcement agencies and the community groups like us came together and sit at the table across each other and really have a robust discussion about how do we address this issue. And the proposal that in front of you today is the best thinking for all of us. I know this is not the only way to address this issue, and it won't be the last time that we address this issue, but this is what the work in front of you today is our collective effort. We support the legislative concept that's in front of you. That includes data collection, trainings for the law enforcement agencies, and the drug policy. With that said, I thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to be working with you all.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Can I call Mr. Barone, please?
Good afternoon, Chairman, Vice Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Ken Barone from Central Connecticut State University. And at the university, we have a public policy institute that works with our General Assembly in the state of Connecticut and also some other states to do a variety of research for them. I'd like to spend a few minutes today telling you about the experience we had in Connecticut. It wasn't too long ago that we took on the task that Oregon is now in the process of doing, which is to pass comprehensive legislation to deal with and address racial profiling. We are 5 years in to our adventure in Connecticut, and I'd like to tell you about some of the experience we've had and some of the lessons that we've learned. As a little bit of backstory, in 2011, the FBI came in and arrested a series of law enforcement officers in the state of Connecticut for violating the civil rights of a group of Latinos in a high Hispanic populated town in Connecticut. This sparked the interest of the legislature in wanting to know why the FBI came in and identified that there was this issue going on and why nobody in the state would have been aware of these trends. Because the state of Connecticut originally passed a law prohibiting racial profiling in 1999. And we began the process of collecting data, similar to what Oregon's looking to do, in 1999. And so the question became, we're collecting this information, we're supposed to be doing something with it, how did we get to this point? And when we, so that we had a new governor at the time, and the governor at the time, when he came into office, had set a few initiatives for criminal justice reform in Connecticut, one of which was to find ways to improve trust between members of the minority community and law enforcement, as a way to improve trust in the entire criminal justice system and to improve legitimacy within the system. Okay. And so in 2011, 2012, this incident happened. The legislature turned to us at the university and said, can you help us try and understand what went wrong? We quickly realized that only 27 of our 106 law enforcement agencies were actually collecting and reporting the data they were mandated to collect. And the legislature did similar to what this state has done, and they put together a task force. And they said to the task force, can you go back to the drawing board and figure out how to make a law that works and one that everybody can buy into? And so we did that work. And it took us, similar to Oregon, a year and a half of meeting with, we put together an advisory board, meeting with all of the stakeholders to craft legislation to electronically collect information on all traffic stops in the state of Connecticut and to analyze that data once a year. The law went into effect October 1, 2013. It impacted 106 law enforcement departments and a little bit over 9,000 law enforcement officers in the state of Connecticut. Although Connecticut is much smaller than Oregon in terms of size, we're not that dissimilar in terms of our populations. About 3.7 million people in Connecticut, about a little over 4 million in Oregon. And law enforcement-wise, I think we're fairly similar in terms of number of officers. The reason why we focused on traffic enforcement in Connecticut and why so many other states focus on traffic enforcement is because it's the most common encounter that citizens will have with law enforcement. And if you want to try and understand the patterns that are occurring in basic interactions between the community and law enforcement, it's a good window into understanding if disparities exist, and then being able to drill down to understand why those disparities exist. I will tell you that when we first passed the legislation, there were a few concerns from legislators that we're now able to report on that I think I'd like to share with this group, and that is the collection of data will require that law enforcement officers are on the side of the road for a lengthy period of time trying to fill out some bureaucratic form. The system was designed in such a way that the average officer takes less than 60 seconds in the state of Connecticut to capture the 26 data points that we require to be captured for each traffic stop. The reason why that's the case is because the vast majority of the data that we are collecting is collected on the back end. Date, time, location. This is all information that with the vast majority of the systems put in place minimizes the amount of time the officer has to spend on the side of the road. And the vast majority of the other questions are yes, no questions, true, false questions. There was also a concern that collecting this data would decrease the number of traffic stops occurring in the state, right, as a reaction to potentially the legislature requiring this type of collection on the part of law enforcement officers. We actually saw an increase in traffic enforcement after the law took effect, and we just closed the books on year three of data collection, and each year the number of traffic stops statewide has increased slightly. And in Connecticut, we did something a little different, and that is that we required that all law enforcement officers distribute a notice to every motorist stopped informing them of their right to file a complaint if they feel they were profiled. That was a really controversial piece of the legislation that the advocates in particular in Connecticut were pushing for. And the concern on the part of law enforcement is that we would see a spike in complaints and would be tying up the internal investigation units of police departments, slowing down their ability to do other work. The year before the law went into effect, we saw 25 racial profiling complaints filed statewide. The year after the law went into effect, we saw 11. The second year, we saw 8. And this past year, we saw 6. So for some reason, traffic enforcement is up, complaints are down, which can only be a good thing. I will tell you that our advisory board continues to meet. We meet on a monthly basis, and we have viewed this as a conversation. And the collection of data, as I've said to many folks today, is step one. You can't have the other tough conversations that are necessary for law enforcement to have, for communities to have, and for policymakers to have if you don't have the information. In the absence of information, the conversation ends up revolving around anecdotes. And anecdotes are okay. Anecdotes paint a certain picture, but anecdotes don't necessarily provide us with the information that we need to be making the best policy decisions possible. And I will tell you, there was a few things that we were particularly concerned about in Connecticut, and that was that we were going to, there are over 30 states around the country that collect information on traffic or pedestrian stops. Most states do one of two things with the data. They either just put it out there. They say, hey, look, we're being transparent about it. We collect it, and we'll put it out there, and anyone who wants to see it can see it. The second thing that some states do is they will take who is stopped in a community, and they'll compare it to one indicator. Okay. In Connecticut, we saw some issues with that approach. And so we took an approach that looks at and analyzes every department's data on an annual basis using 6 different statistical measures. And the idea is that if a department is identified as having statistically significant disparities across multiple indicators, 3, 4, 5, or in some cases all 6 indicators, we then identify that department for a further analysis. And we are now at the point in Connecticut where we're having the conversations about what the data means. What are the factors that are contributing to the disparity in town A or town B? And one of the things that I don't think we anticipated is the degree to which this data is helping us not only understand racial disparities and the factors that are contributing to those disparities, but they're providing us a really great window into law enforcement practices in general. And I want to, as I close, I want to walk you through 3 very concrete examples of instances that we saw in Connecticut and ways in which the data helped us with some reforms. The first I'm going to talk about is a city named Waterbury. Waterbury is a medium-sized city of, maybe 50,000 or so individuals. It's not one of our large cities. It's a very diverse city. Waterbury was a department that was identified with statistically significant disparities when we did our first full analysis. We met with Waterbury several times. We drilled down on their data. We wanted to understand what was driving those disparities. And one of the things we found, which as researchers raised a few flags, was that there was a significant degree of registration-related motor vehicle enforcement in the predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods. And when we met with the law enforcement chief, the law enforcement chief articulated to us that that is as a result of socioeconomic factors. These are poor neighborhoods. It costs money to re-register your car, and so therefore we are more likely to find unregistered vehicles in the high minority area. And what we were able to look at and to try and understand is having an unregistered vehicle, how correlated is that to money, right, in terms of how much is that driven by socioeconomic factors? And what we actually found when we started to run some experiments with the department is that drivers in predominantly white parts of the community were actually 6% more likely to be driving in unregistered vehicles than minorities in their predominantly minority neighborhood. And for the police administrators, this was really great information. They did not know that, right? And so I use that as the first example to say this wasn't law enforcement officers going out there and deciding that they didn't like particular people and therefore they are going to enforce a certain law against them as a result of that. This was, anytime as an officer I've been told to go look for unregistered vehicles, I go into the area that I've always believed to be the most fruitful to find unregistered vehicles. Another example is we had a suburban town that was identified in our most recent report that had, again, statistically significant disparities. As we drilled down on the data, what we realized is that the number one reason for stopping cars in this town was for some sort of a defective light. 1,608 of the motor vehicle stops in this town were as a result of some sort of a lighting violation. The next highest reason for stopping cars at about 740 motor vehicle stops was for speeding. Okay. So just to give you a sense of where the priorities were in terms of enforcement. And again, when we met with the police department and tried to understand this data and engage them in a dialogue, what we found was that the police department was doing what they believed to be good roving DUI enforcement, which is you go and you saturate an area with motor vehicle enforcement as a way to find drunk drivers and get them off the road. And you do that by finding any reason to stop a car that's legal. You speak to the driver, you ask them where are they coming from, where are they going to, and if you stop enough drivers, eventually you will find a drunk driver. And so we then went back to the drawing board. We drilled down on this data. And what we found is that out of the 1,608 motor vehicle stops for defective lighting, the town only found one drunk driver. But when they did motor vehicle enforcement for more serious moving violations, they were significantly more likely to find drunk drivers. And so the town didn't know this because the town prior to this didn't have that information. So for a long time, the theory was you go out, you saturate an area, you stop cars for whatever reason, and that's the way you get drunk drivers off the road. And the data is telling us maybe it's not the most effective tool to get drunk drivers off the street. But there are tools that are good tools for dealing with this issue in your particular town. And the reason why this was of a particular interest to us is because the defective equipment type of motor vehicle enforcement tended to be driving the racial disparity in that town. And the last example I'll tell you, probably the most, the department that's really made significant changes since our analysis. This was a department that was identified in our first analysis, and they probably had the most significant racial and ethnic disparities of any of the 106 departments in the state. They are a suburban town that borders the city of New Haven, which is a fairly diverse city. And in this town in particular, there's one small section of the town down by the border of New Haven that's a predominantly black neighborhood. And the vast majority of motor vehicle enforcement in the town either occurs at the border of the city or in the predominantly black neighborhood. And the type of enforcement occurring in those parts of town tended to be very high discretion motor vehicle stops. They tended to be the equipment-related motor vehicle enforcement and not the more serious safety-related motor vehicle enforcement. And everywhere else in the town, motor vehicle enforcement was safety-related. And again, when we had a conversation with the department, the reasons why they articulated made a lot of sense. That was their high crime, high call volume part of town. So they have more resources in that town because that's where a lot of the 911 calls are coming from.
Thanks.
And it's also the part of town where they've got the biggest issue with drugs and illegal weapons. And so they had created an enforcement approach that's, again, saturated the area, stopped cars for whatever reason they could stop cars for, ask if they could search the vehicle, consent searches were very high, and try and find drugs and guns and get them off the street. So again, we went to work to try and understand how effective of an approach was this. What we found initially was that out of all the vehicle searches they did in that part of town, they only found illegal contraband 7% of the time. And the vast majority of that illegal contraband was less than half an ounce of marijuana. We asked the department to run an experiment with us. We said, can you instruct your officers to stop making those types of motor vehicle stops and to only focus on serious moving violations that drive accidents. Keep the same number of officers in that neighborhood. We don't want you diverting resources to where your high call volume are, but change the quality of the interaction that's occurring between police and members of that particular community. What we found after our experiment was that the racial disparity, number one, disappeared in the data. Their accident rate dropped 15% because they were doing the type of enforcement that tends to decrease accidents. They were getting people off their cell phones. They were slowing them down, getting people to stop running red lights. Their crime rate dropped 5%. And their rate of finding illegal contraband went from 7% of their motor vehicle searches to close to 70% of their motor vehicle searches. The quality of motor vehicle searches went up. But they also weren't searching everybody. They were much more focused in terms of when you search a motor vehicle and how to build good case of probable cause. And since then, that department now, we're 3 years in, has maintained that trend of no racial disparities, a high return on investment in terms of actually finding illegal contraband, a lower crime rate. And part of the thinking in a lot of police departments in Connecticut in particular is the way you reduce crime is by putting officers in your high crime area and you saturate the area with motor vehicle enforcement. And what the data is telling us is that the quality of motor vehicle enforcement is much more important than quantity. Right? And for a long time, law enforcement have viewed, we all actually have viewed this issue in terms of what's our short-term return on investment. If I can get drugs off the street or drugs from one motor vehicle stop and I can place them on a desk and I can take a nice picture of it and say, look to the community, look what we found, right? That's going to help me. The thing that's harder to measure, but that we're now seeing start to have an impact on society, is how many vehicles needed to be stopped to get that one drug bust. That's the long-term return on investment. That is harder to quantify, but is clearly in many communities around the country starting to be one of the main drivers behind decreased trust between members of minority communities and law enforcement, which leads to a decrease in police legitimacy. And so what I will leave you with is just, I think, our opinion in Connecticut that Oregon is well on its way with this legislation to being capable of starting to have these conversations where appropriate in Oregon. And before you can get to the place where you're having the conversations, you have to collect the data. And so I applaud you on your leadership in this effort here in Oregon. And and from our experience in Connecticut, it will be well worth the effort that law enforcement will have to go through to get to this point where we can start to have really meaningful conversations.
Any questions? Ready? Yeah, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Representative Olson, please.
Yeah, Mr. Bruin, I appreciate you coming out here. Enjoy yourself. I know you're used to that here. A couple questions here. My first question to you is, I guess it's more kind of a statement. Connecticut has 2.5 times more police officers than what Oregon has. Oregon is per capita per 1,000 the lowest in the country right now for having police officers. So I say that, but in your training with the officers, have you ever, or are you aware of any type of training that's involved where the officers are trained on how to approach a vehicle with courtesy, identifying who they are, with a greeting, immediately identifying why the individual was stopped? Because we do that here.
Yeah, so training was a big component of our initial legislation, and actually more recently the state of Connecticut passed additional training measures, not just to revamp academy training to address just what you're saying, but also in recertification training for all officers in the state. Not only are they going through that type of training again through the next 3 years, but we also mandate 4 hours of implicit bias training as part of recertification, which officers have to go through every 3 years.
Okay, one more question. If I recall correctly, back in the late 80s, I'm thinking 1989, for about 10 years, the state of Connecticut was hit with a dissent decree by Department of Justice in regards to hiring practices, and you've recovered from that. Okay, we've not had that problem
yes.
here. So.
Yes, I do think certainly we have had some high-profile incidents in the last that's also one of the reasons why Connecticut initially passed racial profiling legislation in 1999. This is an issue that we have been struggling with for well over 30 years. And part of that is as a result of you have some of the most diverse and really some of the poorest parts of Connecticut right next to some of the wealthiest places in the country, right? And I was telling some folks earlier, one of the biggest issues that we struggle with in Connecticut and that keeps showing up every year we do this analysis, the departments that keep showing up, there tends to be a pattern that they're departments that almost always border a major city. And it's some sort of the disparities being driven by the type of enforcement being done on the border. The issue in Connecticut is not necessarily as big in our more urban centers. The issue of racial disparities in traffic stop data is much more prevalent in our suburban communities that border some of our more diverse cities.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
One question.
Yeah,
thank you again very much for coming up from Connecticut. It sounded to me that you're at a place now where you can actually take the data that's been collected and actually start using it. And if I understood it, was it a three-year period that you waited until you actually felt you had the base or the database?
12 months. You really can't do anything with data until you have at least 1 year.
Okay.
So after we had collected 12 months of data, we then were able to start putting together our first report. We do a report for the governor and the legislature every year. We've just closed our third year of data collection, and now we'll be able to. 3 years is really great. Now we'll go back and do a whole three-year analysis this year. But you need at least 1 year.
All right. Thank you.
I just would say I retired from law enforcement, as Representative Wilson is also. And, you know, 40 years ago, we did a lot of that, stop every car that had a violation to see who's in it and what they were up to, and that I can see the result, not necessarily, I mean, where you get the disparate, people would think that it was racially, being done for racial purposes, and it wasn't. It was done, at least in the mind of the police. And then also the training piece that Representative Olson talked about, I've seen officers, young officers start out where they'll come up and somebody will say, well, what did I do? And they say, show me your license. Well, what did I do? And you get in this circle argument, and I would always try to train them to tell the people, I've stopped you because. And they say, well, what if they had done something else and I could get a confession? You get off on the wrong foot. It's easier. Puts them at ease if I know you stopped me because I'm speeding or whatever. So a lot of the training, I think, would alleviate a lot of the problems. But also, I'd like to thank you for your information about the statistics. That all makes a lot of sense, that you can't see from anecdotes what's going on. It really, really does take so you get patterns that make some sense and then deal with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I guess the only thing I would say is some of the what I think a lot of the data is telling us, and I hope I leave you with, is that sometimes there are just unintended consequences of certain types of enforcement techniques that are not driven by officers going out there and deciding, I don't like minorities, and therefore,
yeah.
right? There's a way policing has been done. We're able to measure how effective those tools are, and if they're not as effective as other tools, then most of the time law enforcement administrators say, well, let's use the tool that is most effective at solving the issue that we want to solve, and also hopefully mitigate some of those unintended consequences that just come with the nature of policing.
And if I'm the minority, about the 10th time I'm stopped, it's going to be hard for me to believe it isn't because I'm a minority. This is great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Before we continue with our informational hearing, I need to allow the Senate to vote on another LC.
Okay, please.
So I'm going to go ahead and put us in recess on the Senate side. I'm going to open up, reopen the work session for the introduction, and the chair moves LC 821, which was dated September 30th, 2016, for introduction. It was one that was missed. Our cross checks with our certified smart people outside of the room realized that this was one that we missed, and so I made the motion to introduce it. Is there any discussion on the matter, on the measure? Is there any objection? Senator Cruz, are you still with us? So we still have the number that we need, so we'll go ahead and that motion carries, and we'll go ahead and close the work session on for the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee, and we'll continue with the informational meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You are.
Okay. At this point, we're going to go here, ahead and hear a demonstration on the data comparison dashboard. Michael Schmidt with the Criminal Justice Commission is going to be bringing us up to speed. Mike, thank you for being here this afternoon.
My pleasure.
I did tell you to go home early, didn't I?
No, you didn't mention that, actually.
I meant to. But now that you're here.
Chairs of the committees, of the judiciary committees, and members, thank you for inviting me. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. But more importantly, also a counsel for the judiciary committees in 2013, where I got to work with Rep. Krieger. So, you know, it's always good to appear back in front of you. Today, I just want to talk to you about some work that the Criminal Justice Commission has been doing on analyzing disparity in our system around possession of controlled substance. This came out of conversations with the governor's office early in 2016, where, you know, there's been a lot of national conversation about the war on drugs and disparity across the country. And so the question was, well, what does that look like in Oregon? So what I submitted to you all with my testimony is just kind of a big outline of different things that is important to consider with the data. I'm not going to go through it because I'm going to try to wrap this up in 15 minutes, and it's going to take me a while to get through the data. But, you know, there are some caveats that I'll cover as we go through, but just in general, things to keep in mind. When you're trying to look at disparity in a system, what you really have to do is try to figure out at what rate is the crime being committed, and then compare that to who ends up being in the criminal justice the criminal justice system. And then further in, you know, there's always data concerns, and especially as it pertains to race and ethnicity, our data is often lacking that information. And then third and finally, you know, something to keep in mind as I go through this is that very small numbers can lead to, you know, looking like there's a lot of disparity. And as we look at some of these numbers broken down by county, you know, we're talking about very, very small numbers, especially in some of the eastern counties. And so just keep that in mind, and I'll point it out as I go along. But, you know, those are some of the challenges that we face in trying to put this together. So, where we started, because like I said at the outset, in order to look and examine if there's disparity in the system, you want to see at what rate the crime is being committed in the system. Well, you all, everybody knows that there are a lot of people in Oregon who possess controlled substances that go undetected. Probably the vast, vast majority of people who possess drugs won't ever end up being caught for that specific time, maybe further on down the road, but it happens quite frequently. So we can't really use that data because we don't know who is possessing drugs and at what rate by race and ethnicity. So what we did is we looked at national data from SAMHSA, which is a national drug survey that they have been doing for years and years. And it's a self-reported survey where they get statistically significant sample sizes and they ask people, you know, have you used drugs in the last year? So the very first slide that you see in front of you is displaying that national drug use data. So this isn't Oregon specific, the rest of it will be. But what you see when you look at who's using drugs, and the Attorney General referenced this in her comments, is that more
more or less, it's pretty much between 0 and 3% of all races and ethnicities are report using these drugs in the same year. And it goes up or down. You can see that the majority of reporters said that they used cocaine in the last year, but methamphetamine, crack cocaine, and then heroin. And it kind of just goes up and down by race and ethnicity, but they're at very, very similar rates that people report using drugs. And if you take that and drill down to it a little bit further and you can look at 18 to 25-year-olds, you know, that changes the numbers. But again, race in and of itself does not predict who is using these drugs. More or less, within a few percentage points, racially and ethnically, people possess and use these drugs at similar rates. So I can change that from 18 to 25. We can look at 26 to 34-year-olds, and that changes the demographics. But again, it's always in between that kind of 0 and 4% of the racial and ethnic populations that report using these drugs. So that's important, right? Because possession of a controlled substance, the crime is committed when you possess the controlled substance. So knowing at what rate that crime is being committed in Oregon is crucial to understanding who is in our criminal justice system, if that's disparate based on who's breaking that law. So we start with who's using the drugs, and what we took from that survey data, and this has been described in a lot of different studies, is that racially and ethnically, people use drugs at very similar rates. So now we'll look at Oregon-specific data. This is just high-level, putting all the drugs together. We looked at felony convictions for PCS, and the way we broke this data out is into three different groups. The first group is called all PCS, or just all possession of controlled substance convictions. And so you can see that across from 2012 to 2015, around 4,000 to 4,500 people in Oregon annually will be convicted of possessing a controlled substance. Of that 4,000 to 4,500, a pretty consistent group, about 1,500 people, will be convicted annually, and that conviction will be their first felony conviction for possession of controlled substance. So before that, they were not previously a felon. I should say also that when we look at this data, we're not including people who were arrested with multiple felony convictions. We only look at where PCS was the most serious conviction. So we're not talking about someone who stole a car and had meth in their pocket. They would be a stolen car. So 4,000 people annually convicted of PCS, 1,500 people out of that group will be first-time felons, and of those, about 500 we have no prior arrest data for. Now, both for first-time conviction and no prior arrest, there's always the possibility, and undoubtedly some people who do have prior arrests and convictions that are out of state, and we just don't have access to that data. So some small percentage certainly have those prior contacts. But when we say no prior arrests, when we look into our LEDS database, we could not find any prior arrests before this PCS conviction that ended up in a felony. So breaking that out by drug type, same exact data that you just saw, but this breaks it down by methamphetamine, cocaine, and heroin. This was actually kind of surprising to me, but we, you know, there's a lot of talk about opioids and heroin, but we are still very much a methamphetamine state in terms of the numbers getting convicted for PCS. The vast majority are methamphetamine. You can see overall about 3,600 in 2015 of the 4,600 or so. And then heroin, of course, is the second one, with cocaine being some pretty small numbers. But again, we break it out, all PCS, those who, when they were convicted of this conviction, that was their first felony, and then those who had no prior arrests. So then we can look at that across the state of Oregon.
While you were waiting for that next page, mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question back on that last slide. Just how far back I'm interested in the meth portion. How far back does that information go? Would it go back to 2006?
We could do that. We could pull those numbers. This goes back to 2012, so I don't have it with me right now, but I can pull that
for
you.
Off the top of your head, has it been this way? Has it been flat? Is it
No, I think it really is still a continuing rising trend for possession of controlled substance, meth.
Okay. Yeah. So it hasn't changed really. In fact, it may have been increasing.
Yeah. You know, another thing that you'd be interested to look at would be distribution cases, too, and seeing if those are going up or not, and especially manufacturing cases. Because of laws that Oregon's passed to get at mitigating, you know, how many manufacturing cases happen in Oregon. So those you probably see some more fluctuations in. But, you know, okay. I can find you offline.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So the next slide shows you a map of Oregon. And so we go from 2012 to 2013, and you can select the drug type that you're interested in. I'll check methamphetamine here. We'll go back to 2012, and we'll start with all PCS convictions. And so what you can see here is it's kind of a heat map, right? The darker the county, the more convictions they have. And if you hold the mouse over the county, you can see the total number of all convictions, first-time felons, and no prior arrests. And if you click through the years, it kind of does a time lapse where you can see the expansion throughout the state in PCS convictions. And of course, 2016 data is not yet complete. But so you can do that for all the different drug types and just kind of look county by county and see where those are. So then we wanted to look at the racial breakdown of these convictions. And so that's what this slide shows you. What you can see is, again, we have the all PCS group, the first time felon group, and the no prior arrests, but broken out by the different ethnicities, Asian, Black, Hispanic, Native American, and white. And I'll pick 2015 because, like I said, 2016 data is not complete yet. We're not through the year. And so this first slide shows you just the total numbers, the total count numbers. So in our data, 3,988 in 2015, PCS convictions were white, 41 Asian, 225 Black, 270 Hispanic, 73 Native American. So those are just the total numbers. And obviously, Oregon is a majority white state by quite a bit. So it's not surprising that those are the total numbers we see. But then when you change that to a per capita rate, instead of seeing the total numbers of convictions, this looks at the population in Oregon compared to the total number of convictions. And you see that the numbers change to the rate per 100,000, which for Asian is 25 per 100,000, Black 334 per 100,000, 57, 193, 131 for white. And then just to kind of make the comparison a little bit easier, we do the ratio so that you can kind of do the quick math. And you can see that in our data, in the statewide database, for all PCS convictions, Black compared to white is 2.5 to 1. Hispanic, I'll talk about that in a second, is 0.5 to 1. Native American, 1.5 to 1. And that changes as you look at all PCS, first-time felony, and then no prior arrest. So like I said at the outset, one of the challenges with this data is that we know we have serious limitations of who is represented in our systems by their race and ethnicity. It's not always accurately input. It's not always a priority to input it. And that has to do with our data systems and also national systems that our law enforcement try to correlate their data to. So those are issues that we're well aware of. I know they came out in the Attorney General's task force as they were looking at these issues. And so I'm very hopeful that as that proposal progresses and our data capacity and our collection becomes more robust at the front end, that will help us out a lot with our data analysis. But what we did at the CJC to try to get at what the real difference of that is we looked at a survey. The Department of Corrections gives all inmates a survey when they're admitted, and they ask them to self-report their race or their ethnicity. And so we looked at that survey results and compared that to the data in our system. And so what we essentially found from that was an error rate, and especially in the Hispanic Latino data, we were very drastically, and Native American data, underrepresented in our state databases. So these are estimates that I'm showing you now based on looking at that survey data and comparing it to what's in our system, but we think this more accurately reflects the racial and ethnic makeup of going through our system. So again, you have the total count. You'll notice that the total white number is down by about 500, 600 or so. That's because most people, when they're identified by law enforcement, if there's not a correct category to put them in, they oftentimes end up in the Caucasian or white bucket, so to speak. So that number goes down, and you see the Hispanic number and the Native American number rise quite a bit. So when I change this from count and instead go to rate, you see very similar rates for Asian and Black, but the Hispanic rate and the Native American rate go up, and I'll change that to the ratio. So the Hispanic number comes a lot closer to a 1-to-1 for all PCS and 1.5-to-1 for first felonies and no priors. The Black numbers stay relatively consistent, and the Native American numbers increase quite dramatically. So we can do this for every county in the state, and this is where things get pretty tricky. Some of the bigger counties have bigger sample sizes, obviously, but some very small counties have extremely small sample sizes. So I think it's always important to have the total count number available when looking at this data, because you could be talking about one more arrest or five more arrests, and that can completely skew the data. So a nice way to deal with that is to look over time. You can click through each year and compare the counties year by year. So sometimes you'll see that, especially in those very small sample size jurisdictions, the disparity numbers can vary quite drastically. And that's because of the small sample size. But some of the bigger counties, it is still instructive to look at the disparity by county. And so this, again, just like the other ones you've seen, you can change from count to rate. And then you can click on a specific county to see what the what the rates are by race and ethnicity for those convictions for methamphetamine, cocaine, and heroin. So I clicked on Multnomah County, and you can at a glance see how Multnomah County's numbers compare to the statewide numbers. And we could do that for any county.
And could I ask you, so where we have virtually no law enforcement in Southwest Oregon, so nobody's probably, or not many people are probably getting arrested because there's nobody to arrest there down there. So is that, you think, affecting your counts at all? Or?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Resources always affect arrest rates, for sure. And, not only just police, but also jail resources and other law enforcement resources certainly have impacts. So one of the things that, I've been working with all the law enforcement agencies and associations as we've been working on this data. They've been extremely helpful to us as we try to crunch these numbers and understand it better. And one of the things that came out is conditional discharge as an option for possession of controlled substance. And the Oregon District Attorneys Association has been particularly helpful to us in giving us feedback. They're actually polling their different district attorney offices to give us very specific data. And so we wanted to look at, how many people are getting conditional discharges. So this is a map of all that. Conditional discharge, I should back up, is an option for a prosecutor, if they elect to do it, to offer somebody instead of just entering a conviction of guilt right there. They would plead guilty and then be given some course of supervision and treatment. And if they complete that at the end, then that, instead of being a conviction entered, the case can be completely dismissed. So that's conditional discharge. So we looked at that across the state to see where conditional discharges are happening. And again, you can look at it by rate and ratio and the total number of conditional discharges happening, and you can click on it by county. This is not an option that all counties utilize. Some counties do, some counties don't. And then this is kind of the final slide on conditional discharges. Annually, about 1,200 conditional discharges are given every year, and half of those will end up in failures and convictions, and half of those will be successfully completed and will end up in complete dismissals. And so here on this chart, you can go county by county and see how many conditional discharges are given compared to the state, and then what the success or failure rates of those are.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, and we're obviously the weather's not improving any. So the presentation on the future of legal services, Amber Hollister and Judge Garrett, please.
Thank you, chairs, members of the committees. Chris Garrett, judge in the Court of Appeals, and I'm joined by Amber Hollister, general counsel of the Oregon State Bar. We're here to give you a very brief, and I promise it will be brief, update on a new initiative that's being undertaken by the bar. And I'm going to ask Ms. Hollister to begin by giving you some background, and then I will get more specific in the final few minutes of our presentation.
Thank you.
And I don't mean to cut you short, but if we could, you know, if we could do the storm version.
We have a very modest objective here today.
Co-chairs, I'm happy to keep it short. Okay. It's Amber Hollister, general counsel for the Oregon State Bar. The bar, as you know, is an instrumentality of the Judicial Department. We're a mandatory licensing entity, and we are unique to some extent when compared to our counterparts in other states. We're very transparent. We encourage public member involvement. So we are here today to talk to you about a futures task force that the bar has convened to take a look at how we can better provide legal services to Oregonians, how we can protect consumers, how we can increase access. We've formed two committees of that task force. One is focused on leveraging technology to provide more affordable legal services to Oregonians by providing better technology to lawyers. So worthy goal. The second one is focused on regulation. It's called the Regulatory Committee, and it is chaired by Judge Garrett. It's focused on It's focused on really looking at whether there are any regulatory, statutory barriers in place that impede access to justice, or if we could revision our regulatory structure to enable greater participation by non-lawyers. So that's essentially where we are. We're here because we want to be proactive, we want to seek solutions, and we want to work with the stakeholders in this area. So with that, was that brief enough? I'm going to turn it to
appreciate that.
To Judge Garrett.
And so is everybody else sitting behind me.
Thank you. And I just want to be clear as I begin that I'm here today in my capacity as the chair of this committee. I'm not here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm not speaking for the courts. So this committee comes out of a recognition that our regulatory structure for the practice of law was established a long time ago and may or may not be well suited to serve the needs of the changing legal market today. The existing regulatory structure was designed around the traditional face-to-face lawyer-client relationship, and the fact is that the market has changed. Technological innovations combined with a recognition of the great underserved populations and unmet need for legal services have combined to create some new players who want to enter the market for legal services. You may have heard of companies like LegalZoom and Avvo, which have their origins in providing forms online for people to perform their own legal services, write their own wills, for example, or to be referral sources for attorneys. But those companies are now innovating to the point where they can even provide actual legal services online. And it's in recognition of that that the State Bar Board of Governors has made a decision to, as Amber said, proactively address whether our current regulatory regime is is adequate to the task of regulating those new entities, or whether we need to make changes to the rules of professional conduct, the ethical rules that guide lawyers, to the court rules, or to the Oregon statutes themselves. And so we're here really just to let you know this effort is happening. We had our first meeting a couple weeks ago. We'll be meeting throughout the first half of 2017. We're charged with bringing our report recommendations back to the Board of Governors in June of 2017. And it's entirely possible we'll be back in front of you later in 2017 to talk about possible legislative concepts. We wanted you to know about this now, because this is an effort that's gaining traction around the country as these new entrants in the market are seeking changes to states' regulatory systems. It's possible that in the coming session you will hear some from some people who want to have that conversation. We're encouraging you to give this process that we've just commenced time to work out while we go about this in a comprehensive and systematic way. And with that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Okay, anybody have a question?
I'd comment. Yeah. First, I want to thank the bar. They gave me an opportunity when I was up in Portland to have a short presentation about the program. I did hear earlier this week on NPR, they were talking about implementation in the state of Washington, where that's been ongoing, and then they got another set. So it does look like this is timely. I'm really happy that the initiative has been taken to move us forward to see how we can accommodate. And of course, their issues in some areas is actually how they are moving forward to try to provide quality services at a reduced price. And I just remembered it wasn't on NPR. It was actually on my CLE that I'm getting for this year's reporting. That's where I heard it.
It is that time of year, Mr. Chair.
It is that time. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I need to make an announcement.
Okay. I just have a really quick question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Your Honor. It's great to see a fellow Griffin on the other side of the dais.
But two I did, of them, actually.
And both of you? I had no idea. Okay, so I just wanted to quickly ask you, it seems a little bit related, that I've heard that the passage rate on the Oregon State Bar has gone fairly dramatically down due to some changes in the exam. And I don't know how that plays into this technology, but is that something that the bar is taking a look at? I mean,
so co-chairs and Senator Rosenbaum, AG was just here. I can address that. So you're right that there was a lower passage rate for this year's bar than there have been in recent years, and the Oregon Supreme Court's Board of Bar Examiners has convened a task force to take a look at our passage number that folks are required to achieve on the UBE, on the portions of the exam. They are taking a hard look at that, and ultimately it will be up to the Oregon Supreme Court to determine what they want the number to be for passage.
And we do have members of each of the three law schools are represented in the work we're doing. So we'll be in constant discussion with them throughout this process.
Yeah, and I think for clarification, we need to put on the record, this is one time, this most recent result, and I'm glad that they were looking at it, but I'm not at this point, let's say, hitting the panic button as compared to until we really get in to see what could be the issues or reasons why. So thank you all very much. So before we do our next panel, I do want to let everyone know, if you are here for the last panel, which is the prevention of commercial sexual exploitation of children concepts, the presenters have requested to be canceled for this presentation today. So if you're here in the audience for that, I just want you to know that so you will not be waiting without it going forward. So with that, I believe that brings us up to our next topic, which is the update on concepts from Distracted Driving Task Force. We have a number of individuals that are going to be presenting. I have five that are scheduled, including our own Representative Olson and Senator Courtney. At some point will probably be coming in. But I'll leave it up to the panel to decide on how you want to proceed and who will come first.
Well,
Chairman Barker, Chairman Prozanski, members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of Oregon's Department of Transportation. We're here to talk about distracted driving, and I appreciate the circumstance we find ourselves in, and I will give you that storm version that you requested. You know, distracted driving has become a pervasive and entrenched activity or behavior in our society. I would submit to you it's become an epidemic facing our country and this state, with fatalities and injuries increasing each and every year. So what to do about it? I'm proud to say Oregon jumped in to the mix to investigate the root causes of distracted driving and identify steps to reduce the occurrence of distracted driving. Along with my partners seated at this table, as well as many others, ODOT, the Oregon State Police, and AAA Oregon, Idaho brought together professionals from a variety of backgrounds to work together to reduce fatal and serious injury crashes by changing the cultural norms around distracted driving. There were 20-plus organizations representing transportation, academia, research professionals, law enforcement, the courts, communication and media professionals, and healthcare, as well as legislators, that met once a month beginning in May through December of 16th, formed task force, engaged in root cause analysis to determine the primary causes of distracted driving in the state of Oregon here. That root cause analysis was vital in terms of guiding the discussions and developing the recommendations that will make them their way into a final report, which will be produced at the end of the year. It's in draft form here. Major root causes identified: limitations with the current cell phone law creating difficulties to cite and convict. That's ORS 811-507. We'll speak to that a little later. The lack of good data on crashes, citations, and convictions of distracted driving. Variability of the educational programs utilized by courts. The addictive behavior, this reward-seeking behavior folks have. A pattern with cell phone use. And communication silos between the various stakeholders in this. As I said, in its final report, you will see a host of recommendations. I'm going to speak about one because it tees up the future conversation. Amending the current cell phone statute. The Oregon Appellate Court found that the statute does indeed prohibit talking and texting on a mobile communication device, but not all the activities that can be performed using such a device. This 2015 decision set in motion a change in traffic enforcement, limiting the use of ORS 811-507 to only cases where the officer witnesses talking or texting with a handheld mobile communication device. A policy choice presents itself to us, I believe, from this court ruling. Should the state of Oregon and Oregon law related to distracted driving go beyond just talking, just texting? And you will hear from a couple of colleagues, legislative colleagues, who were part of the task force that worked with the task force to inform its members and improve what I think are legislative conflicts that will improve enforcement and distracted driving here. I think with that as tee up, I would turn to my friend from AAA Oregon and Idaho, and then on to the superintendent of OSP to share some thoughts.
Thank you. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Prozanski, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon Idaho. Also, we'll keep my comments very brief. AAA Oregon Idaho and our national affiliate has done a lot of research over the last several years around distracted driving. And the work that we've been doing with the Distracted Driving Task Force is going to be putting forward legislative concepts that we wholeheartedly support. They are going to close loopholes that currently exist largely to the advancement of technology beyond the reach of what the original legislation envisioned. And it is critical that we continue to work down that road. In addition, of course, a lot of the research that we've done has indicated not only are people more aware and more concerned about distracted driving. 80% of those folks that were part of the research indicating a great concern about distracted driving. But it also indicated that that a large number of us, half of us, read and our texts or our emails while we're driving, and most of us still talk on cell phone while we're driving. The legislation you're likely going to see is not going to go as far as AAA would ultimately like to go, because we found there's very little difference between distracted driving, dealing with using your hands and hands-free, but we need to take each step in turn. ultimately, we would like to see legislation that deals with distracted hands-free driving, because there's what they call a technology lag. That's the time that whenever you're interacting with your device, it takes about 27 seconds for your brain to re-engage fully in your driving. And that's time you're missing children in the street, obstructions, red lights, and things like that. And so until we get to the point where we are truly getting drivers to focus on driving and solely driving, we're going to continue to have distracted driving-related fatalities, injuries, and damage. So with that, AAA definitely supports the work that the Distracted Driving Task Force has done. We critically need good data, and we're looking to our law enforcement partners to start trying to gather that data as they see the cost of crashes and see whether or not they can link that to distracted activities. And of course, AAA is always supportive of the idea of providing education to motorists, because education provides prevention and causes folks to drive with better practices than they do now. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the superintendent, and thank you very much for the time.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Pozanski, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Travis Hampton. I'm the superintendent of state police. I'm going to skip my prepared remarks. I had a lot of data that I brought with me today, but in the interest of time, I'd like to make a more heartfelt plea from a patrol officer's perspective. I also want to thank Captain Teresa Bloom, who's seated in the room with me. She is the expert in this field. She leads our patrol division efforts statewide. And as a member of the task force, I thank her and others for their efforts. But I really wanted to come here today to underscore OSP's commitment and recognition of distracted driving as an issue in Oregon. So I'd like you to speak to some of the hurdles and strategies we employ to combat what I think is an epidemic or level of proportion of people using their cell phones while driving. I know I'm a bit of a broken record on this topic, but I can't come before you without speaking to OSP staffing. Since 1980, when OSP was removed from dedicated funding, we've seen the state's population increase by over 50%, licensed drivers increase by over 50%, while OSP patrol resources, road-ready troopers and sergeants have decreased over 40%. So right away, I'm limited on my resources to combat distracted driving, many other elements. So OSP has got, we had to learn to be smarter where we dedicate our resources in our non-obligated time. Non-obligated time where we're not on a service call, where we're actually looking for behaviors that cause crashes. So very data-driven, we work with our partner, Director Garrett at ODOT, to determine what behaviors drive these crashes, fatal motor vehicle crashes especially. Third year in a row we are up, by the way, some double-digit increases in fatals on Oregon's highways. So we determine the top five driving behaviors that contribute to these crashes. We coined these behaviors OSP's Fatal Five. Mm-hmm. Right now, they've been fairly unchanged for the last several years. It's speed, occupant safety, lane usage or departure, impaired driving, and distracted driving. Distracted driving is not the least important. It just makes up the D and a handy acronym of SOLID that our troopers start the day with, knowing that that little word spells out those five driving behaviors, so they have a target enforcement when they hit the road. I hear it the same as you all from friends, family, citizens. Hey, Travis, I see every third driver on the road has got a cell phone in their hand. Why cannot you do something about this? I would just encourage anyone that asks that question to try to spend a day in a patrol car that says state trooper on the fender, and that light bar, you find yourself in that bubble of angels driving down the road around you, because they see you, they recognize you, and people are pretty gifted in putting that cell phone below the dashboard when they're communicating. OSP does make about 400 to 500 enforcement contacts a month for distracted driving, almost all cell phone related. We do employ, as a strategy to combat the that marked car bubble, we employ 40 unmarked patrol cars around the state. We began using these vehicles in February of this year, and with that, we did see an increase of over 23%, nearly 24% increase in our traffic stops, enforcement stops for distracted driving. Director Garrett spoke to probably our biggest hurdle in enforcing distracted driving cell phone laws is the confines of the current case law that a police officer must see an individual talking or texting on their phone. Just not enough that you could see them holding the device up even to their ear. We have to swear and affirm that that person is talking on their phone or texting when they go by. The 21-year-old Trooper Hampton may be able to see that going by on highway speeds, but the person before you today cannot. Without my glasses, I probably can't tell if you are talking on your phone across the room. So we welcome these changes to case law and legislative concepts, and I just wanted to affirm and give you my pledge that OSP is dedicated to combat this problem and that we very much support and appreciate the work by the members of the task force. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Any questions?
I just want to, you know, fill in. I appreciate Director Garrett asking me to be part of this and everything, but Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, to relieve your feelings about all this, we had a justice of the peace. We also had a city a judge involved, and two circuit court judges involved too, as we went through with all this. And boy, we met a few times, let me tell you. I'm feeling pretty confident where we're at right now with the direction of this. And you know, obviously the educational piece is going to be a critical piece that ODOT's going to be involved in. We talked about that. The engineering piece is what this LC is all about. And then the third piece of the three E's is the enforcement piece. So, and that's the tool that we're giving law enforcement now to kind of try to make us a little safer.
Sounds great. Representative Krieger.
You know, I just was thinking, we travel a lot back and forth and to and from the Capitol for the last 16 years, and I can remember eating in the vehicle and having a drink spill on me and like that. GPS, people are looking down in that. They're playing with their radio. There's all kinds of things that distract people that it's just going to happen. You can't, otherwise society would be trying to govern us down to how often we got to breathe per minute in a car. So I'm just saying, yeah, we need to find out if there's things we can change or correct behavior, or at least make people aware through education. But unless you're in a cocoon there and there's nothing around you, I don't see how you're ever going to get away from it.
So one other thing. Sure. Chana really helped us out quite a bit on this, and then Heidi Elliott, too. I mean, she was just, we were bouncing around stuff with her all the time. So those two need to get credit, too.
Mr. Chair, just really quickly, I know we don't have time, but
we do.
So this is a huge problem, and I really appreciate what OSP and everybody else is doing about enforcement with inadequate resources. I have heard that there is technology available that's being resisted by the providers that would actually deactivate devices in moving vehicles, and that's, I mean, even if we could find the resources and change the law, it seems like there is never going to be adequate enforcement resources to really deal with what is an epidemic, in my view. And it just seems crazy to me that there's technology that would actually make people safer, but we can't sufficiently pressure providers to activate it and make it mandatory.
I think, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chairs, Senator Rosenbaum, I think you posed a significant question. I will tell you the folks that came to the table that do represent those industries as part of this task force, I think they understand that technology has created some component of distracted driving. This is becoming a cultural norm. They also know that technology can help solve it. So I think we will continue to work with them around the table to work the three E's, as Representative Olson indicated. They know that the gravity of this issue needs to be dealt with, and they are part of the solution, because I think they have a little responsibility, to be very honest with you, as we do. And I think what's important, changing cultural norms, it just takes time. It also takes applying evidence-based interventions and successful partnerships and community engagement. We all own this. I think that's the reality, and that's what we walked away from all the players of the task force. It's just one section. We all own this, and we individually own this as we move forward to make sure that we are focusing on driving, not all the other activities that are available to us when we're driving a car. Chair Barker, Chair Przanski, if I can, we have teed up a public service announcement.
That's what I was going to ask.
And while I can put together no combination of words that actually can speak to the gravity, that beautiful young girl, Alexis Thurwanger, and her family can. And if we could just take a few moments of time, I think we'd have a
I was going to ask if we were going to play that, but
yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Okay.
My daughter, Lexi, she had a heart of gold. She was full of energy and full of compassion. we would go to breakfast, and she'd be like, that guy's a veteran. So we would buy him breakfast. We would see someone homeless. She would, Mom, just give me a couple dollars. She would go out of her way to make sure that everyone felt included. Fishing with my dad, she loved it. It was their time. Family, friends knew. They threw a pool party. She would be the lifeguard. She always, I mean, literally always had her phone. She slept with her phone. She ate with her phone. She showered with her phone. She was very social. Everyone loved her. When she left her friend's house, there was evidence of texting or Facebook. She dropped into a dead zone, and about the time of the accident is when cell service would have kicked back in. Was it her phone binging off saying, hey, notifications are coming through? I don't know. All I know is that she would look down, and that wasn't the place to look down. And I know if she had it to do over, she wouldn't. She had the world ahead of her.
We have noticed a tremendous increase in fatal car crashes here in Oregon. We can rule out impaired driving or fatigue driving, and during the investigation, if we can get access to the phone, we can go through the phone records or through statements that people tell us that they were on the phone. One of the tools that we're using is unmarked vehicles. They're out there to help us save lives. We can detect those handheld electronic devices or other distracted driving. Anybody that's out on the road is in danger if somebody's on their phone. Asking people to do is to take a pledge, not only from themselves, but to talk to family members and friends, ask them to just stay off their handheld electronic devices and focus on the road.
There is a void that I don't think will ever fill. If I can stop one person from having to go through what my family went through, there is no phone call, there is no text that is worth taking your eyes off the road for 1 second, because that's all it takes. It just takes that one moment. And you don't get a second chance.
Chair Barker, Chair Posansky, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We also have Senator Courtney wanted to give a presentation on this bill, and then we have a couple of LCs on this. So, President Courtney, do you want to come on up? And before we move into the other two, I don't know if you have some comments on the topic we have before us.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, I'm members of the respective judiciary committees, the House and the Senate. I'm Peter Courtney, I'm a state senator, District 11. So I feel guilty because I don't live very far away, and most all of you do, so I know what's going on outside. So by being here, you're going to get home a lot later, so I'm feeling bad. So I don't know whether just to rush through this or whatever, so... I'm here to support a concept, LC 1105, and it's my understanding, and I don't know if this has already been presented to you, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Barker, Representative Barker, these figures, something about, and these are new to me, but I just know how I react to what happens to me when I'm driving. Distracted driving crash, we know, occurs about every 2.5 hours, we're told. That's in Oregon. A person is injured in such a distracted driving crash about every 3 hours here. Distracted driver crash involving a cell phone occurs more than five times a week. Almost five people are injured or worse each week involving this kind of driving, and that almost 1,500 people a month are convicted of using a cell phone while driving. Nearly 1,600 Oregonians participated in a 2016 survey. So this is this year still. And this is what they found. 84% feel uncomfortable with a driver who is distracted. Now, I assume that means you're in a car as a passenger, or you're driving and you see someone is on the phone. So I think it applies to both. I'm not sure. But 44% admitted to driving distracted with a passenger. And this next statistic is really fascinating about human nature. 75% admitted to driving distracted while alone. And I can almost identify with that. I'm not going to tell you about how flawed I am, but I can actually see, I don't know why, like when no one's here, I'm going to do it. And I know, I don't mean to be funny, but literally that is a dramatic statement that if someone's in a car, you know, under 50%, but if they're not in a car, I'm going to it. So, you know, do with that what you will. What this measure does, and it's dramatic, it makes penalties for using a mobile communication device while driving the same as penalties for driving under the influence. Exactly the same. That's exactly what this measure's done, up or down. 1 year in prison or $6,250 fine or both. Increases to 5 years in prison and $125,000 in fine for multiple violations within 10 years. So that is what it's done, and let's learn it in High Council. Heidi Elliott is here. She helped draft the bill. In fact, she did draft it. And this is a policy. This is a significant policy change I'm asking you to consider in your individual and collective wisdom. Between 2005 and 12, the number of drunk driving fatalities per person decreased by 28% in our state. I had no idea that was the case. Yet even as drunk driving fatalities rate continue its decade-long decline, the danger of distracted driving is worsening as smartphone usage increases. The number of fatalities caused by distracted driving increased 28% between 05 and 08 alone. According to a National Highway Traffic Study Administration study, drivers under 25 are three times more likely as older drivers to text while driving. And I can understand that because young people, that's how they communicate. I learned that with my sons and my that's how they communicate. Young people are less likely to consider texting and driving to be unsafe. 60% of 18 to 20-year-olds reported sending text while driving to be very unsafe, compared to 95% for those who are older. So even though most state laws outline texting while driving, the associated fines are usually far lower than those for drinking and driving, even though several studies show they can be equally as dangerous. So I could go on and on here, but I'm going to stop because I have another paragraph or two. So the bill is simply a policy decision. Shall we or shall we not increase the fines and penalties for use of a cell phone and while driving? And I do appreciate the fact you'd even allow me to come here this late hours, and I'm very appreciative of that. And I hope I haven't deferred or kept you too much longer. And as I say, I have learned in High Council here with you to go to any of the particularities in terms of the technicalities of the bill.
Any questions at this time? I don't see any, so we'll go ahead and close the informational hearing on the update and concepts on the Distracted Driving Task Force. We're going to go ahead and open up a review of the Revised Uniform Athlete Agents Act, LC 1366. Mr. President, floor is yours.
Again, Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 11. My star witness, because of weather, the Honorable Lane Shetterly, former state representative, law commissioner, the whole bit, cannot be with us. He was coming. I am introducing this bill on behalf of the law commission. I'll stumble through what it is. The reason is I introduced a similar bill about this years ago at the request of the athletic administration of the University of Oregon and their football program. Again, Peter Courtney, State Senator, District 11. I'm supporting the LC 1366. As you know, I follow sports. I do, closely. 6 years ago, I was troubled by the effects of unscrupulous athletic agents having on college athletes. And it was rampant, and particularly at the University of Oregon. And it was very much a destructive force down there in the extent that they came to me and said, we need help. An extensive expo in Sports Illustrated outlined the problem. Some agents
were permanently luring college athletes into contracts with gifts and cash. As a result, some athletes were ruled ineligible. Their whole college career is gone. And you must understand, I'm sure you do, if you're at the University of Oregon or Oregon State, even Portland State, many of those athletes, this includes women now, because we do have women's professional basketball, they think they're going to the pros. That is what they want to make their living at. They're trying to get into the pros. And yet, they, in being in college can really help where they're drafted, etc. And yet, their eligibility is shot if they make a mistake. Coaches who facilitated these illicit contacts were dismissed and banned from coaching in the college ranks. That also has occurred in Oregon and is rampant across this country. In the most high-profile case, former University, I'm very familiar with this case only because I follow sports, I'm sure you are, University of Southern California running back Reggie Bush was stripped of his Heisman Trophy and the Trojans were forced to vacate their 2005 national championship team. That is a famous case involving a famous athlete, and our country happens to be in the Pac-12 as well, and the famous USC Trojan football team that won the national championship. All gone because of this kind of content. Working with knowledgeable members of the athletic department staff at the University of Oregon and Oregon State, I introduced Senate Bill 5. We were unable to pass it in 2011, but in 2013, the legislature passed a similar measure, House Bill 2032-96, which cracked down on agents and exploiting young athletes, for that matter, the assistant coaches. I come before you today at the request of the Uniform Law Commission and my former colleague, Lane Shetterly. This measure is the Revised Uniform Athletic Agents Act. It would modernize Oregon's law for the ever-evolving sports commercial marketplace. First, it expands the definition of sports agent to make sure it applies to all those activities as agents and on their behalf. A practice of particular interest in Oregon, this legislation exempts individuals acting solely on behalf of a company engaged in consumer brand marketing. That means it doesn't apply to what? Nike. And I wasn't supposed to say that, but that's what that does. Additionally, it includes reciprocal registration with other states, a central location where an athlete's agent credentials can be reviewed by student athletes and institution, very, very important, enhanced agency contract requirements, additional notification requirements, and there's a few more. And I am comforted to know that I have Learned and High Counsel Anna Braun with me, who is standing in for Lane Shetterly should you have any technical questions, because it is a modernization of the bill that the Law Commission has requested, and as they say, they asked me to introduce it. So I think it's pretty startling to go from incredible to distracted driving to this, but this is a problem in our world of interscholastic competition, particularly at the highest level, the Division I level. So thank you. That's what that is.
All right, thank you. Any questions regarding the concept? Mr. President, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the intro on the review of the Revised Uniform Athlete Agents Act, LC 1366, and open up a review on the sex offender sentencing concept, LC 1104. Mr. President.
Well, I should leave while I'm ahead, because... So again, Peter Courtney, State Senate District 11. This little bill I've been dealing with for a while, I've gotten nowhere, and I want to be optimistic, but I don't know. And I have beside me the Learned and High Counsel, along with Anna Braun, this is Jessica Menifee, who actually wrote the bill, because when I drafted initially, the Learned and High Counsel drafted the bill, and they said, in a very clinical way, we drafted it, we'll introduce it, but of course you're totally unconstitutional. But I did it anyway, because you do that in politics. But the fact is, they then took the bill back, and they drafted it in a way, those two, regardless of what I said, and they did it in a way that makes it very constitutional. And actually, it's a very erudite approach to a serious predatory sexual offender that I feel very strongly we should do something about. I'll just speak just naturally. Years ago, I was on the Governor Barbara Roberts Task Force on Sex Offenses. At that time, there was a horrible crime involving a young little boy. I think the individual was in Washington. Took a young boy, he tortured him over days, and eventually sexually assaulted him, and then he killed him. And he served on that commission with that father, and I couldn't look at him. I couldn't talk to him. It just strangled me. Adams is out of all that. All the measures that are on the books today involving background checks, neighborhood notification, et cetera, came. And I introduced them over many, many years. And I became aware of what we mean by a sexual predator. And it's I moved away from the area for years because I just burned out on it, and it really I didn't like to talk about it. I just didn't like to deal with it anymore. But I've always felt, and back then we actually experimented with certain bills. You may remember this, Senator Brzezinski, I thought we did with certain chemicals and things that we thought we could introduce into the system and actually treat these individuals so that they wouldn't be sexual predators. But I believe everything we attempted, because I remember carrying some bills on the House floor, it failed. It failed. I think the most dangerous offenders are sexual predators. We don't understand them. We cannot cure them. And they are monsters. They are terrifying monsters, more than even many murders. They are monsters. But the one group of sexual predators that I don't think we really deal with is a sexual predator that does something to a child that is so horrible that that individual should be given a life sentence. First time. We don't do that in any other law. And that is what got me in trouble at Learning High Council from a proportionality standpoint. So what this bill attempted to do early on when I first wrote it is you commit a crime for a child, was it 12 and under or 12? Which was it?
Under 12,
and it listed the crimes, really heinous stuff. You're convicted, life sentence, the key is thrown away. And the child can live. That's not, murder was not a factor of it, they can live. And I introduced the bill. And that is when I learned, High Council, probably that was unconstitutional the way it was drafted. So it's been redrafted in a way to require a sentencing technique so the DA would bring charges against an individual who's committed these kind of crimes, child under 12. They would be convicted, but then you'd have to go through a whole new sentencing procedure before the sentence, life sentence would be given. And actually, it's not a pure life sentence, if I'm not mistaken, counsel. And you could even go back and examine the person after so many years. But it would come down very, very, very hard on a first-time predatory sex offender who commits a crime against a very young child. That is the measure. Now, the detail is all here. Jessica Menifee here is, of course, the leading criminal justice counsel we have on this case. Your counsel will help write it along with Honor Braun, and they can answer the questions. This is a bill that, I'll be frank with you, and Senator Brzezinski knows this, maybe you all know this. The criminal defense attorneys aren't crazy about this bill, just be upfront with you. No one asked me to introduce the bill. Crime victims didn't. DAs didn't. No one has asked me to introduce this bill. It's just that there was a crime. There was an individual in Washington County. He committed three heinous crimes like this. They caught him, sentenced him. Did it. So many years later, he's out, does it again and again. Had he gone, if this bill existed, it's very possible he'd have committed that first horrible one, but he never would have committed the second or third because he would have been behind bars. So I'm speaking very generally, Senator Brzezinski, Representative Barker, and I know that. But rather than just read this thing, I thought I'd just say it. So I'm very grateful you'd even hear the bill. It is controversial, I assume. And for all I know, you may find it difficult to accept it from a policy standpoint, and I get that. So that's what it does, in a very general way, Your Honors.
And I just would like to say that the case you talked about, the guy that killed that little boy, I knew the detective that investigated that case. He was never the same after that. Had dramatic effect on hearing the confession, ruined the detective's life. It was that bad of stuff. That was a horrific case.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Krieger.
Just one. We've all heard in the Judiciary Committee since I've been here, which isn't as long as you have been, stories of this type and an attempt by society to isolate these people and not allow them to continue. And I really agree with that wholeheartedly, but I want to make sure that we separate the non-violent predator type of juveniles from that. I just had a meeting the other night with some guy named Brewer, Dumenez, and Balmer. Had dinner with him. And we heard a story about a 12-year-old boy who had touched a girl years ago. Today, if he'd done that, he wouldn't have his present job
as a captain of a nuclear submarine. So I think what Senator Courtney is trying to do with these adult predators is something that all of us that have children and grandchildren agree with entirely.
Thank you. Lurden High Council has pointed out to me that the defendant was at least 18 years of age at the time of the offense, correct? That is, that they would have to at least be 18 years of age. Again, I thank you for that, and thank you. And I think that is the kind of detail and heavy core discussion that should take place, because that I totally sympathize with you. But that's why Lurden High Council was here. There's a lot, incredible thought went into this bill by Jessica Menefee and Anna Braun. And so right there, I read the language, I hope, speaks somewhat to what you're saying, Your Honor.
All right. Any other comments or questions? Mr. President, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I was hoping you'd really examine me on that one.
I have your coconuts menu here.
I think he's excited about that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. He should be. He goes over here.
All right. I think that.
I just say on the weather front, the passenger in my daughter's car, who they left 2 hours ago, they're already got to Tigard.
Oh, good.
So it's going to be a long drive home tonight.
All right.
They already got to Tigard.
So, unless there's any other business for the Senate, and I'm not seeing anyone saying they have any other business, I'm going to go ahead and say thank you to the members that were stayed in and for Cruz being able to be part of our discussions as long as he could. And we are going to adjourn. Hopefully, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year's, and everything else.
Merry Christmas to everybody. Happy holidays. And we're adjourned.
Floyd, are you driving?
I'm taking the train.
Who takes the train?
I came up. Train.
Who takes the train?
I came up.